This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
He shall from time to time give to Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. That's a line from Article 2, Section 3 of the U.S. Constitution that's morphed into the President's annual State of the Union address. And most years, that address has a section devoted to education.
We should recruit and support more great teachers for our kids. And we have to make college affordable for every American.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll review President Obama's final State of the Union address. We'll also hear two stories about nuns doing their part in the fields of education and public service. And we'll spend an academic minute learning how religion can affect your health. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge.
Mr. Shaker, the President of the United States!
For the eighth and final time, President Barack Obama, as he is wont to do from time to time, stood before a joint session of Congress and delivered his annual State of the Union address. The speech was given in the midst of an extremely partisan primary election season, and rather than go through a list of proposals that had little to no chance of ever being voted on, let alone enacted, he looked back at some of the accomplishments of his time in office. And as always, education got its fair share of camera time. After speaking about the economy for a few minutes, he pivoted to his administration's actions and aspirations for education in the U.S. And just a note, we've edited the applause breaks here because some of them were pretty long.
For the past 7 years, our goal has been a growing economy that also works better for everybody. We've made progress, but we need to make more. And despite all the political arguments that we've had these past few years, there are actually some areas where Americans broadly agree. We agree that real opportunity requires every American to get the education and training they need to land a good paying job. The bipartisan reform of No Child Left Behind was an important start. And together we've increased early childhood education, lifted high school graduation rates to new highs, boosted graduates in fields like engineering. In the coming years, we should build on that progress by providing pre-K for all, and offering every student the hands-on computer science and math classes that make them job ready on day one. We should recruit and support more great teachers for our kids. And we have to make college affordable for every American. No hardworking student should be stuck in the red. We've already reduced student loan payments to 10% of a borrower's income. And that's good. But now we've actually got to cut the cost of college. Providing 2 years of community college at no cost for every responsible student is one of the best ways to do that. And I'm going to keep fighting to get that started this year. It's the right thing to do.
And if that call for free community college sounded a bit familiar, well, that's because the president made that same call in last year's speech, but that initiative went nowhere in Congress. Later in his speech, Mr. Obama turned his attention to American innovation, talking about the past successes of American scientists and entrepreneurs over the years, and calling for a major new and rather ambitious initiative for the future.
It turns out many of our best corporate citizens are also our most creative. And this brings me to the second big question we as a country have to answer. How do we reignite that spirit of innovation to meet our biggest challenges? 60 years ago, when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny Sputnik was up there. We didn't argue about the science or shrink our research and development budget. We built a space program almost overnight, and 12 years later, we were walking on the moon. That spirit of discovery is in our DNA. America is Thomas Edison and the Wright brothers and George Washington Carver. America's Grace Hopper and Katherine Johnson and Sally Ride. America is every immigrant and entrepreneur from Boston to Austin to Silicon Valley racing to shape a better future. That's who we are. And over the past 7 years, we've nurtured that spirit. We've protected an open internet and taken bold new steps to get more students and low-income Americans online. We've launched next-generation manufacturing hubs and online tools that give an entrepreneur everything he or she needs to start a business in a single day. But we can do so much more. You know, last year, Vice President Biden said that with a new moonshot, America can cure cancer. Last month, he worked with this Congress to give scientists at the National Institutes of Health the strongest resources that they've had in over a decade. So tonight I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you think, Joe?
Make it happen. Vice President Biden, of course, lost his son, Beau, to cancer last year. Many say that was a major reason he declined to run for president in 2016. Mr. Obama then continued his pitch for science and innovation.
Now, medical research is critical. We need the same level of commitment when it comes to developing clean energy sources. Look, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely, because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But even if the planet wasn't at stake, even if 2014 wasn't the warmest year on record, until 2015 turned out to be even hotter, why would we want to pass up the chance for American businesses to produce and sell the energy of the future? 7 years ago, we made the single biggest investment in clean energy in our history. Here are the results. In fields from Iowa to Texas, wind power is now cheaper than dirtier conventional power. On rooftops from Arizona to New York, solar is saving Americans tens of millions of dollars a year on their energy bills and employs more Americans than coal in jobs that pay better than average. We're taking steps to give homeowners the freedom to generate and store their own energy, something, by the way, that environmentalists and Tea Partiers have teamed up to support. And meanwhile, we've cut our imports of foreign oil by nearly 60%. And cut carbon pollution more than any other country on Earth. Gas under $2 a gallon ain't bad either. Now we've got to accelerate the transition away from old, dirtier energy sources. Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future, especially in communities that rely on fossil fuels. We do them no favor when we don't show them where the trends are going. None of this is going to happen overnight. And yes, there are plenty of entrenched interests who want to protect the status quo. But the jobs we'll create, the money we'll save, the planet we'll preserve, that is the kind of future our kids and our grandkids deserve.
The president then went on to talk about security and national defense and a number of other topics in a speech that lasted just under an hour. He finished on a strong, optimistic note.
That's the country we love. Clear-eyed, big-hearted, undaunted by challenge, optimistic that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. That's what makes me so hopeful about our future. I believe in change because I believe in you, the American people. And that's why I stand here as confident as I have ever been that the state of our union is strong. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
There was one question the president could not answer that night. Who'll be up there delivering that speech next year? The College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, has seen its share of changes over the years. One of the most obvious is the transition of the faculty from religious to secular. In fact, there's only one nun left teaching at the school, and she is the founder of the college's music industry program. As the best of our knowledge's Dave Lucas reports, Sister Mary Ann is still going strong after almost four decades of cranking out the hitmakers.
If we're lucky, each of us had a teacher or two who inspired us, mentored us, even changed our lives. Many people in the music industry wouldn't be where they are today if not for Sister Mary Ann Nelson, a nun who has taught recording engineering, artist management, and rock and roll. She founded the College of St. Rose's Music Industry Program in 1981, has directed it ever since, and coincidentally is the last nun to teach at the once all-girls Catholic school, the only full-time instructor remaining on staff.
Over the years, I was very fortunate to have a lot of support and creative freedom that the sisters gave to me. Actually, they taught me how to teach. I had great teachers. The sisters were amazing. And, you know, as I was a student and then started back here as a teacher, I had great resources. I had great mentoring.
Nelson's official title is Associate Professor of Music Industry. She's enjoyed her time, especially as electronics transitioned into the digital age.
Years ago, it was a big thing. It was analog. I remember carrying big transformers in Europe. Everything, you know, just weighed tons of equipment. Nowadays, I can walk in with a laptop, a couple of small microphones, cables, and I'm in business. We've miniaturized it. You know, prices come down as well as the weight.
Nelson is the reason why Billboard has thrice named St. Rose to its lists of the top music business programs in North America. But starting the program wasn't easy when the majority of music schools and conservatories based their academia on classical music.
We really had to fight to get some ground to make popular commercial music viable. It's just part of the territory. So I think being able to create a program and an environment where students who want to learn music technology, who don't necessarily want to work in the classical field, can legitimately come in and work with just about any style of music, pop, rock, EDM, metal. One of the other things I'm pleased about, the jobs and the situations that my students have found on their own. And then they're willing to come back and work with today's students, network with them, give them opportunities, in some cases teach them.
She stays connected and involved with many of her past students, now in the performance or technical fields or working with record companies.
They email me every so often telling me what they're up to. When they're back in town, they frequently stop in to see me. I maintain a working relationship with some of them to this day.
Kelly Bradford runs a music management company in London. The 2012 graduate can't imagine what life would have been like without Nelson's music curriculum.
I started off as a music education major and realized that that was not a thing for me at all. And so I switched over to the music industry, not knowing anything about the course, not knowing really anything about the music industry, just knowing that I loved music. And Sister just took me under her wing and really showed me the ropes. I learned about law and contracts and just making sure that you keep your contacts and how to run a venue and, of course, her incredible, incredible recording skills. She's just one of the coolest chicks I know and just a really, really important person at St. Rose. She changed my life and changed, I know, all of my friends' lives. So I just can't possibly imagine St. Rose without her or my life without her.
Nelson's office, classroom, and recording studios are in the college's Hearst Center for Communications and Interactive Media building. St. Rose has had clergy on the faculty since its 1920 founding. Music was one of the first majors offered. As the years passed, the nuns have retired, and many have died. When Nelson retires in a few years, there could be none left.
I'm to the point now where I am almost ready to hand it off to a new generation. We've been very fortunate in being able to bring aboard several new faculty members. They're young, they're innovative, they're performers, they're writers and arrangers, and they know the technical world. I could leave this Friday and they could carry it on.
Despite decades of teaching, Nelson believes even today, women remain underrepresented in the recording engineering industry.
When I started in pro audio, there were very few women in the industry, either in the live end of it or the recorded end of it. Those that were in it were doing more jazz and classical music, and I've been able to see that turn around to some extent over the years. There are more women now in the engineering side, both live and recorded. But back when we started the program, it was the exception rather than the rule. And there are several organizations now, Women in Audio, Song Girls, a couple other organizations, that really create a network for women that are either in pro recording or pro live audio.
Nelson believes many of the women working who graduated from her program likely would not have been able to carve out positions in particular niche markets they now dominate had they not had the opportunity to attend St. Rose and exercise artistic freedoms. You may recognize this piece by 2011 graduate Allie Crystal.
Counting down the days until I can see my favorite place.
Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
Still to come, there's another nun working hard in another part of the country, but her calling couldn't be more different. That story's next on the Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. For more than 40 years, Sister Sue Kinsel, a sister of the Holy Cross in South Bend, Indiana, has visited the county jail. As the last remaining overseer of a bail bond fund, Sister Sue helps low-income individuals post bail so they can continue working while they await trial. She does this work voluntarily because, as she says, the people that are there are people, and they need the same things that all of us need. By her own estimate, Sister Sue has handled over 2,000 bond cases, and she has no intention of slowing down. From the series Kind World, Zachary Ezor from WBUR in Boston reports.
Once you hear prison and jail, you think someone bad. You think of someone bad, right? But we've all done bad things, wrong things, right? Just maybe haven't been caught. I'm Sister Sue Kinsel. I'm a sister of the Holy Cross, and I've lived most of my life in South Bend, Indiana.
People don't always reach out to people who have broken the law. And that, I think it takes a special person and a special quality. My name is Maria Kazmarek. I am the executive director of the Dismiss House of South Bend. Her name is by the payphone, her phone number. Everybody, you know, when you say Sister Sue in certain areas of the city, they know who she is. You know, Sister Sue has been known to actually protest and actually been, you know, arrested and carted off to the county jail, you know, during a sit-in. And people would bond her out, and she'd be so mad because she said, I don't want you to bond me out. I'm trying to, you know, make people aware that this is not right.
The main reason most people are in jail is because they don't have the money to get out. If you or I were there, someone would be there right away with the money. But most people are there because they don't have the money.
You know, $500 is a lot of money. Families contact her to help with the bail. They may be able to scrape together $250, and that's their commitment. And then she can, you know, match that. They can, you know, actually post bond and continue working until their case is resolved.
I probably have about $15,000 in the fund. So sometimes I can tell them right away how much I can help with. If it's been the breadwinner, probably will or has lost his job. You know, what are they going to do? Talk to a mother who has two teenage girls who are living at home, going to school. They're there by themselves. How are they going to pay the rent? So I see close to 10 people a week. Then I just go through my questions. Your name, your address, your phone number. Who do you live with? What's the charge? How long you been here? What's the bond? Have you ever been arrested before? To be honest, there are very few that I would refuse to do some kind of help. I think everyone deserves a chance.
People who have been incarcerated or in jail probably have had many failures in life, and often many people weren't there for them. When you talk with her, she doesn't say, oh, you know, that's horrible. She just listens. And I think that's the thing, is that she sees community. She sees them as being part of her community.
I mean, people will come up to me and say, oh, you helped me, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. I said, oh, okay. You know, and how are you doing now? I don't remember what they were there for. That's not what's important. Important is what you're doing now.
And that report from Zachary Ezor from the series Kind World. How you feel about religion may affect how you feel. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Having negative beliefs can affect your health. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Brick Johnstone, professor of health psychology at the University of Missouri, details why how you feel about your spirituality can lead to better or poorer health.
Individuals who blame karma or a higher power for their poor health have more pain and worse physical and mental health. That's according to a new study my colleagues and I conducted. We studied nearly 200 individuals to find out how their spiritual beliefs affected their health. Participants had a range of health conditions such as cancer, traumatic brain injury, chronic pain, and others were healthy. We divided the individuals into two groups, a negative spirituality group that consisted of individuals who felt abandoned or punished by a higher power, and a no negative spirituality group that consisted of people who didn't feel abandoned or punished by a higher power. We asked the participants questions about their emotional and physical health. Those in the negative spirituality group reported significantly worse pain and worse physical and mental health. Those in the positive spirituality group reported better mental health. In general, the more religious or spiritual you are, the healthier you are, which makes sense. But for some individuals who have even the smallest degree of negative spirituality and believe they're ill because God is punishing them for something they've done wrong, their health is worse. Previous research has shown about 10% of people have negative spiritual beliefs. For example, believing if they don't do something right, God won't love them. However, when people firmly believe God loves and forgives them, despite their shortcomings, they have significantly better mental health. This research suggests targeted interventions to counteract negative spiritual beliefs could help some individuals decrease pain and improve their overall health.
That was Brick Johnstone of the University of Missouri. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.